start off with this statement here. You've probably seen this in Lamb's book, the header for his article on turbulent motion. And in my sixth edition from 1932, although I didn't buy it that year, I found it, and this is what I copied for. Then I got curious, and I started looking back in our library, and I could get back to the third edition, which was published in 1906, and it was still there, already there, I should say, some 20 years after people began to even be aware of turbulence. So it was, and a perfectly good statement for today as well, of course. Okay, that was not the title page. Here's the title page. And there is my title. Well, the title is published, is What is the Turbulence Problem? As I worked on it, I realized that there's another question goes along with it, what is turbulence, and that they're not the same question necessarily. I had given... So I have two cartoons dealing with those two questions. I'm sure most of you have seen this one already somewhere along the line. What is it? And this is really, I think, it's not just for fun, but I think this is really the point of my talk here, that I think that the problem of turbulence, or at least I think the original problem of turbulence has been forgotten, or, well, it's not clear what to do about it. The second question, what is turbulence, also has a suitable cartoon. You all know about the blind man trying to figure out what an elephant looks like. I put this together back when it was in August 98 when I gave four lectures at UC Irvine, also organized by the physicists there, also a little program on turbulence. And I gave four lectures, and what I'm doing today is condensing them into 30 minutes. So I won't be able to kind of give you a satisfactory proof or support for everything I'm going to say. It's going to be a lot of assertions, which you're probably not going to like. Okay. Now, what is turbulence? You're going to get tired of going back and forth between these two questions. I'll keep on bringing it up. Can you hear me all right back there? What are the attributes of turbulence? When you give a course on turbulence, you usually start off by trying to describe its various attributes, properties. And, of course, the number one on the list there is the disorder. That's where the name comes from. Turbulence is disorder, randomness, chaos. That seems to be the outstanding attribute. Fluctuation or unsteadiness is essential for turbulence. I suppose there could be spatial turbulence. I thought you mentioned turbulence in solids. Did you? No? Okay, I misheard you. But fluctuation is, of course, part of the problem. But down on the bottom, I've also listed verticality. It's got to be fluctuation in a vertical field. A fluctuation in a sound field is not turbulence, for example, or other examples of unsteadiness. Enhanced diffusivity, the fact that turbulent flows diffuse things much more rapidly than their laminar counterparts. Then, say, multi-scale, there are a lot of scales in the flow, broad spectrum. Three-dimensionality, that a flow, for example, that would, whose laminar counterpart is two-dimensional, for which boundary conditions would suggest two-dimensionality, will nevertheless go three-dimensional. That's considered to be an essential part. Well, I've given these things some stars. The highest score, or most important thing in my mind, are the two red stars and this one. And the others, you may be surprised, I don't think are really essential to the turbulence problem that I'm going to be talking about. And you'll see what I mean by that. Now, we know that turbulence is described by two sets of equations. Oops, got a little hydrodynamic lubrication there. The Navier-Stokes equations, of course, describe a turbulent flow. And you're talking about Newtonian fluids, of course, here. And the Navier-Stokes equations describe exactly what's going on in a turbulent flow. People in the past have questioned that. Do you need to bring in fluctuations of the molecular scale or something like that? But I don't think there's any difficulty. That's the same in air as in water. And then on the other end of the kind of some range, the Reynolds average equations also describe a turbulent flow field exactly. They describe relationships between a point in a turbulent flow field. Now they describe the mean relationships of the mean velocity field to some statistical correlations, particularly the Reynolds stresses, you'll see. Now, you know, having that, you know, if you start thinking about this, the question is, what would a turbulence theory be? Is something in between these two? Is there another equation that would be appropriate, or what? Or simply a methodology? And it's not an easy thing to kind of come to grips with. What would that be? Okay, I'll just quickly run through these equations. I don't think we need too much of that. I've written down first the Navier-Stokes equations for incompressible flow. The Reynolds equations, of course, come from the usual decomposition of the mean value and a fluctuating part. And then you get back what looks identical to the original equation, except there's this other term, which is a correlation of velocity fluctuations and represents momentum transferred by turbulent motion. And the way it appears in the equation, you call that Tij, then it is a stress. It's really momentum exchange, but it has the same action as a stress. In fact, the laminar stress, let's say in a gas, is also momentum exchange by fluctuation at the molecular level. It's really the same kind of a thing, but at very different scales. Okay, now, in the case of the Navier-Stokes equations, you want an equation for the velocity field, and you need to close the equations, so you need a relationship between tau ij and the velocities, and that's furnished by Newton's law. That's the closure for the viscous equations. And in the simple-minded way, you say, well, we need a similar closure for tau ij in the Reynolds equations. And in fact, that's how you proceed at first. That's how people start right at the very beginning in the last century. No, not the last century, the century before, when they first encountered this problem. You know, they realized that these, that they call them effective stresses or apparent stresses, they were much bigger. You know, if you want to account for what you saw, you have to assume that this was bigger than what the Navier-Stokes, than what the theory and experiments had shown for laminar flows. And so you introduce, call it eddy viscosity. Usually, you divide through by rho for incompressible flow, and so you use the kinematic viscosity instead of the dynamic one. Well, the simplest thing to do is to assume, and this is how it was done, that nu t has a value bigger than the molecular value, and you just, you know, keep a little notebook, I guess, of what will work for different flows, and these are just numbers. And in fact, I'm astonished to find out that people still do that. I think that in many cases in atmospheric scientists just pick a value, 10 meters squared per second, if they want to try to, you know, work through the equations for turbulent flow. 10 meters squared per second is approximately 10 to the 8th times the molecular value in air. Big, much bigger number. Somewhere here, I'm not sure I'm going to get to it, but I have to emphasize that this coefficient is a property of the fluid, and this coefficient is a property of the flow. And people sometimes get too enthusiastic and forget that. And that's going to be a very important part of this whole thing here. Now, you can do better than that. You can start to try to model this from the dimensions this has to have the dimensions of velocity times length. And in turbulent flows, we always talk about a velocity scale and a length scale. So let's say that nu t is proportional to ul, and put a constant in front of it. So that ul over nu t forms a Reynolds number, which we call the turbulent Reynolds number. And that is 1 over c. So that would be a constant in a class of flows. And indeed it is. In free turbulent shear flows, that's pretty well what happens. You have that satisfied fairly well, rather astonishing. Well, but you can get more sophisticated. Instead of having u here, you can take the square root of the fluctuating kinetic energy, and that has the dimension of velocity, and try to work that in as an equation. And that was proposed by Kolmogorov, you might be surprised, and by Prandtl during the war. So these were independent proposals. This led to still other things. You can put in nu t equal to constant times k squared instead of kf over epsilon, where epsilon is the dissipation rate. And that also is has the right dimensions. And that has led into models that are incorporate other equations. I think I may mention, you probably all have heard about the K epsilon turbulence model, which is considered by engineers to be somehow a better model than the simpler ones that are based directly on the Reynolds equation. Well, it's kind of interesting to see, you know, here you go. If you want to look on that as some kind of, it's not a theory, it's modeling, but they all work. Why do they work? Well, because you've got different constants you can fit in. And I think that Lewis Carroll had the appropriate remark on this, that if you don't know where you're going, any road will get you there. And that's kind of the situation in turbulence modeling. And people don't really appreciate that, because as long as you have even one constant that you don't understand, that's not a theory. But it could be useful, and it is, nevertheless. Well, I've got a repetition on this view graph. I'll just leave that off there. But you can go on and form still other Reynolds average equations. You can form an energy equation and write down an equation for the mean kinetic energy related to various terms here and for the turbulent part of it. And there's a very important one here, that the rate at which the mean kinetic energy is changing is equal to minus the Reynolds stress times the velocity gradient locally. So that term represents energy being taken out of the mean flow, and it is energy being put into the turbulent flow. So this is the turbulence production term. And that, in my mind, is probably the most important bit of information out of the Reynolds equations, that turbulence production term. Another term that modelers figures terribly important is the dissipation. In a way, it looks like the turbulence production is balanced by the dissipation, but there are in between here some other terms called convection terms, which convect turbulence energy into and out of your point of observation. And I'll have more to say about that later. So this, in my mind, is kind of the most important information coming out of the Reynolds equations. Well, this procedures of going to higher order equations and introduce those, when you do that, by the way, like in K epsilon, you end up not with one constant, but with half a dozen, five or six, I'm not sure, just constants. And you try to select the best fit to as many flows as you can encompass with it. Well, this is the kind of stuff that engineers, I guess you'd say, have to do, but it doesn't get any respect. I'm not, by the way, don't just say, I'm not an engineer. I don't know anything about engineering. I'm not sure if I'm a physicist. I don't think I am. I had a degree in engineering physics, so I'm kind of schizophrenic. But anyway, there was this article appeared in 1992 in the APS News, which had a little derisive view of all of this. And you can't blame them. You know, you got what is kind of a theory or a model? You've got six constants you have to fit. You know, what's the use of that? So, that is a view of some people about engineering models. But I should say that engineers have the same kind of view about what the others are doing for them. Now, about the same time, or a little earlier, another physicist made a statement. They made this statement, you know. It appears at the banner headline of a chapter in his book. But you can also say mathematicians come and go and the problem of turbulence remains. And for that matter, engineers come and go. And so it's invariant under profession. It reminds me that when I came to Caltech, or when I was a graduate student in Caltech in the 50s, somebody there that I respected a great deal, you know, discussing the problem of turbulence, and he made the remark that, well, all that it needs is a good mathematician to work on it for a couple of years and the problem will be finished. Well, that was 50 years ago, and still not done. Okay, so what is the turbulence problem? Well, you know, I'll say right on the front, there are probably many turbulence problems. Probably, I'm sure in this room there are a lot of turbulence problems. But there is the original problem, the mother of the turbulence problems, that appeared at the end of the 19th century when engineers realized that the Navier-Stokes equations weren't working for them. And that is, so I'll call that a subset of the turbulence problem, and that is to model and predict, try to get a theory for fluxes, that is exchange, turbulence exchange, of momentum especially, that's the central problem, and then also of other things that might be carried by the flow. And this is for turbulent shear flows. So the operators are fluxes and shear flows. And as I mentioned earlier, the flux is enhanced tremendously. As a rough rule of thumb, you can say that the enhancement of flux compared to the laminar counterpart is about Reynolds number divided by 100. So at a Reynolds number 10 to the 8th, you have a million times as high a transport. Now that number 10 to minus 2 is, you know, somewhere 10 to the minus 2 to 10 to the minus 3, perhaps. So that, I believe, is the original problem that Whimsy had forgotten about. Now, how about the other side of this? What is turbulence? Well, that's a hard thing, too. I made my little list of turbulence attributes, but the approach to this question, I think, represents all these activities, trying to get at what is turbulence, never mind the problem and its solution, which you seem to be able to only do empirically. Can we get at the physics? And I guess this is going to be the main topics for discussion at this conference and at this program. I don't know if we have all those things there. Now, I've emphasized that I'm going to talk now only about this problem of turbulent shear flows. And the turbulent shear flows themselves have subsets. You probably can't just get a theory for all the turbulent shear flows. And the subsets, you know, that kind of developed are free shear flows like jets, wakes, and mixing layers. There's the wall-bounded shear flows, coet flow, pipe flow, boundary layer, and others. Coet flow would be kind of the ideal flow representative of this, but that's a very hard thing to do experimentally. And then, I didn't know quite what to do with a lot of other turbulent flows. I just call them cellular flows. That is flows that you get in convection, in rotation, and I'm not sure if I just threw that out as everything else. Now, getting back to this, to these subsets, how do they differ from each other? What's essentially different between them? Well, for the free shear flows, I'll just make the statements and maybe offer a little demonstration. They're independent of Reynolds number, above some Reynolds number. And it follows that they must be independent of small scales above some Reynolds number. And the large scales are dominant. In wall-bounded flows are Reynolds number dependent, always. But not for rough walls. And people don't spend much time on rough walls, but I think there's a real important place to look, because in some ways the rough wall flows are simpler than the smooth wall flows. And they are small scale dependent. The wall, I believe, there's a lot of argument of what controls a wall bound flow. Is it the wall region or is it the outer flow? I believe it's the wall region, but it's coupled into the outer flow. So that makes it complicated. It makes this set of flows, I think, much more complicated than that set. And then the cellular flows, then you say the same thing about them, depending on whether they're walls or not. Free buoyant flows, or flow up a wall, buoyant flow up a wall, that sort of thing. Well, I'm not sure if I shouldn't skip a whole bunch of pictures I have of free turbine shear flows. Well, first, I think before doing that, this is important. These flows I mentioned for the free turbine flows, never mind the bottom one, which is for a boundary layer, have a kind of an underlying vertical, mean vertical structure. The velocity, the mean velocity in a mixing layer looks like this, and the vorticity, which is minus du dy, dv dx is negligible, well, then it looks like this, and you can lump this all into a sheet and talk about Kelvin-Helmholtz instability, or you can lump it into individual vortices carrying the same circulation and look at that problem as kind of the underlying basic physics in it, which involves the instability of this vorticity distribution. The other flows, and that makes that one really the simplest of this class of flows. The other one, the plane jet, has a vorticity distribution like this, which really is two vortex sheets or two rows of opposite vortices. Similarly, a wake is just the negative, the mirror image of a jet. So those distributions of vorticity, I believe, are fundamental in what that flow does. Well, very quickly, here is a turbulent jet at a Reynolds number of about 10 to the fourth. Never mind, it says supersonic, but it's really sonic here, and the flow is pretty well subsonic throughout. It has a certain spreading angle. Here's a jet at a Reynolds number 10 to the eighth, and it has a certain spreading angle, which you can't make a precise measurement, but it's about the same. Here are a couple of jets at, I don't know what Reynolds number. These are astrophysical jets. Looks a little bit like the other ones. Well, what I'm saying there is that over that range of Reynolds numbers, those flows, each turbine flows, are probably independent of Reynolds number. Kind of hard to believe that laminar molecular viscosity is going to have any effect on those high Reynolds number flows. And if you want a fundamental problem for physics has ever been solved, is to predict the spreading angle of that jet and everything else that goes with it. If you know the spreading angle, you really know everything about it. That jet of a picture of a jet from a rocket motor being tested on a test stand, knowing what you know from the laboratory at lower Reynolds numbers, you can predict what's going to happen if you know the thrust of the jet, which was given in that figure. You know the thrust of the jet, you can predict the velocity distribution, the shear stress, really all the mean quantities in that jet just by scaling up from the laboratory. So one calibrating constant does it. For wakes, there's a similar situation. Here's a wake, this famous picture of tomatoes at a Reynolds number of 100, and look at how that is spreading. If that were laminar, you wouldn't get that diffusivity. Here, and that's at a Reynolds number of about 140. Here are two flows at Reynolds number 4,000 and something greater than 10 to the 7. This is a ship that's leaking oil in some kind of a current, and those things look very similar at those greatly different Reynolds numbers. I'll skip the mixing layers because I'm coming back to them. Now, here I go through an exercise to estimate why Reynolds number is not important in free turbulent flows. And it's because if you just make an estimate of how the turbulent stress compares with the laminar stress, this is of the order of nu u over delta. Here you can pick delta to be the length scale. That is the thickness of the shear layer. And this quantity is the order of 0.01 u squared, usually bigger than that, but that's kind of a limit. And that gives you this thing. In other words, they're of the same order at a Reynolds number of 10 squared, and this will be down to 1% at Reynolds number 10 to the fourth. And that is the rule of thumb that people use, that for Reynolds numbers greater than 10 to the fourth, the flow is independent of Reynolds number. But I think it's really, you know, operated even the lower Reynolds number. It depends on the flow. Now, independence of Reynolds number for the free turbulent flows, people know about that. I mean, everybody talks about it glibly, but nobody makes use of what it implies. It implies that not only is nu unimportant, but it implies that small scales are important, because small scales form at higher and higher Reynolds numbers. And in fact, it's really basically what Kolmogorov says. There's a range of small scales which are not energy containing. The energy is all in the big scales. Okay. And then there's another, you know, I have a lot of discussions about this with my good friends. Why is dissipation so central in trying to make models, in the engineering models and everywhere else? Because if viscosity is not important, why should dissipation be? And suppose you had a flow with nu equal to zero. There wouldn't be any of this conventional dissipation into heat, but would the flow then look different? Well, I would think not. There may be some singularities in there developing, but I don't think that flow, that is an enlisted fluid, would show any basic difference in the mean flow field. That is maybe one of the important messages or assertions that I want to make. Well, Srini, you remember this one. So I asked myself, why is so much effort expended on the small scale structure? And I was reminded of the blind man, or the drunkard, I guess it is, looking for his wallet. And his wallet is over here in the shadows, but he's looking over here under the light. And the light is the Kolmogorov light. That is what makes everybody work on small-scale turbines, because there you have something to get started on theoretically. And so that's what, maybe I'm wrong about that, but that may be one reason there's so much effort on that small-scale structure. Pardon? It is. Well, let me say that I think that Kolmogorov really did throw some light on what's going on. And what I say really is already described by Kolmogorov, that the large scales, where all the energy is and where all the action is, send dissipated energy, energy that's doomed, so to speak, by the exchange process. It's a little bit like an elastic collision. A momentum exchange requires a certain amount of dissipation, and in a turbulent flow, that dissipation is first of all into small scales, and then finally into heat if the viscosity is available. Otherwise, it'll stay in small scales. Marcel? No. But as part of the Kolmogorov argument, at least the way we give it to students, is that it relates only to small scales. But it, I think, says that those small scales reside at high Reynolds numbers at the end of the energy spectrum. Right, yeah, I know. That's what I said at the beginning. I'm quite aware. That's really the point. Pardon? The point is that I believe that the free turbulent shear flows don't require any input, knowledge, etc., from the small scale structure. That what?
It's like saying the mean field theory
Not, no, no, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that for the mean field theory, you need a different physics. And in fact, that's what I hope to say, that some of this is emerging. Except that my 30 minutes are up. Yeah, okay. Well, maybe we can carry on a little discussion as we are doing. Okay, now the next part of my lecture has to do with coherent structures in which I've had some involvement. And what have we learned from them, or how does it contribute to all this? So again, skipping a lot of U graphs here. I keep showing these two pictures because I think it's really... So this is a picture of a mixing layer at a Reynolds number. The Reynolds number increases continually, but here the Reynolds number is about 10 to the fifth. And it's a fully turbulent flow with small-scale structure and so on. But but you can see the large so-called coherent structure in there as well. And here you see it even better. This is a movie that's been around for, or at least some pictures out of a movie, been around a long time, which is exactly the same flow, except the movie set up has kind of wiped out all the small scales, and you see only the large structure. And when you look at this movie, it's like looking at the ocean. You've got these waves coming, rolling along here. And in fact, they tend to join up to make bigger ones. That was thought to be an important part of this, but I don't think it is. But the main thing is, you've got these instability waves. And in fact, the reaction to this was, why do you call that turbulence? It looks like instability. Well, it is instability. And as we went on with this, you could make correspondences. If you took linear instability theory for that flow, calculate amplification rates, it turned out that amplification rates always seem to correspond to the growth rates. And the growth rate is a measure of the turbulence activity, of the stress and so on. For example, it corresponded for various parameters, for the velocity ratio, for density ratio, for Mach number, even for the effects of gravity if you have a buoyant force on it. And the question is, well, what does that mean? And why does the linear theory work so well? I mean, this is not a linear problem, but somehow the amplification rates were an indication of the turbulence activity. So that's the suggestion. And then there were other things, exciting the shear layer with known frequencies, a famous experiment by Ostrow-Ignansky which showed that if you put a pure tone on the mixing layer, it did not grow linearly, that it responded to that frequency over some part of it. And you got the general idea that a free turbulent mixing layer is not kind of a self-supporting thing. It responds to the environment through the response of the instability. Whereas most approaches to turbulence are looking for something, kind of a local constitutive equation, which you're going to build on, and it's not related to any of these external influences. Okay. Well, there is a new turbulence model for the Reynolds equations, which are based on, in which some of these ideas have been incorporated, the idea of an evolving instability. It appeared in the Proceedings of the Royal Society back in 10 years ago, and I kid my British friends by saying they should have published it in Journal of Fluid Mechanics or somewhere, where it would be more obvious. But I won't try to go through with you the details, because that would take an awful long time, but basically, you start with the methodology is to start, say, someplace in the mixing layer where you know the velocity profile and the thickness, and from that you calculate, apply the Rayleigh instability equations and calculate the fluctuations that go with that, and from that you get the Reynolds stress. Then you put the Reynolds stress back into the Reynolds equations for the governs the production of energy, and that gives you a new value of d delta dx. There's a whole kind of collection of integrals that relate d delta dx to u prime, d prime, and so on. And that results in a really good correspondence with what we know about the turbulent mixing layer for, shows the effects of Mach number, density ratio, and so on. There are no calibrating constants, and it contains no, high K. K now is not kinetic energy, but wave number. There are no high wave numbers in this, and there are no small scales. Well, my time is up. Yep. Sorry, I can't quite hear you. The constant, there's no fitted constant. Well, that's the common story, but I don't think that's true for free turbulent flows. Carl?
I would like to rise on the center of Komagawa.
Komagawa. Okay. Who claims that? No, I don't think so. Information about it. Whose theory? Well, no, I hope you don't misunderstand me. I'm not knocking Kolmogorov. I'm just knocking you guys. No, what Kolmogorov...
You know, the local light was implied that...
No, I'm just saying that's where everybody goes because that's where you can make some progress. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that local light at all. I think it has done a great...
I think that we have set up the intermission time for questions for Carl, but maybe you'd like to put a closing few graphs.
Okay. Yeah, I'd love to. Could I do two? Is it brief? Well, again, back to what is turbulence? And I say that for the mixing layer, it's a train of Kelvin-Helmholtz wave packets. Very different from the usual view of turbulence. And they are dependent on external forcing. They have broadband convective instability, and that's usually dominant because the environment is usually broadband. But if you put in a pure tone, you pull out of that for a while a response to that tone, which really upsets this mixing layer. It stops growing completely. You can kill off the Reynolds stresses. And then later on, when it gets out of that range, it picks up again. I say... We're talking about here, that's smaller, scale smaller than Kelvin-Helmholtz. Maybe that's a little bit, maybe I have to go a little bit smaller than that. I don't know. That they play no role. Or determining U prime, V prime, and therefore D delta, DX, and everything else about the mean growth of this layer. I say that the role of those small scales is to transfer, to degrade the kinetic energy that's doomed by this momentum exchange to the viscous dissipating scale. And that is Kolmogorov, as I understand. Kind of the interpretation of Kolmogorov. This one?
Would it be
Well, I don't have time to go into the other free shear flows. I think these ideas apply to the other free shear flows. It's more complicated because there's a more complicated vertical structure.
And why I'm saying that, because if you remove them in some way, you have to go with the free
shear. No, I don't think you do. On a computer, I think you do. But I think in real life you don't. Oh, that's a that's a different problem. That's not Newtonian anymore. You're quite, and that's at a wall. That's in water. No, I don't think if you go to a high enough, large enough scale that they'll have any effect on a free turbulent flow. Well, I say I'm making a lot of assertions here without Carl. No, the other way around. The casket, absolutely not. You are talking now about turbulence in a box, not about a turbulent shear flow in which the instability is continually driving the mixing layer. The last sentence? Well, I'm just saying that, you know, the question, I think that this dissipated energy in the Kolmogorov range, that's dissipated energy. If you don't have viscosity, it'll just stay there, smaller and smaller scales. There's no reason for the dissipated energy to be in small turbulent motions than it is for it to be in molecular motions. Okay. Right. Okay, I know. You wouldn't say they dissipate energy. They represent the dissipated energy in some way. They would have to be the dissipated energy. Well, I'm talking about turbulent. Yeah. Okay. There are all kinds of turbulent systems. I'm talking about an open system, the turbulent shear flow, like the mixing layer. You have mean kinetic energy that is being lost from the mean flow. It's going into the mixing layer. Now, where does it end up? People say, well, eventually it's got to end up in heat. But it needn't end up in heat. It can just end up in turbulent motion and stay in that mixing layer forever. And that. Bill, you've been trying to get your.
I basically agree with everything, but.
Well. Okay, I would call that not residual Reynolds number dependent. I'm quite aware of that. I would call that residual effect of initial conditions, which at the beginning are affected by Reynolds number, but not later locally. Yeah. Okay. No.
Great question.
Any more?
No more questions, though. I think we should let the next speaker.